Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here and delighted to be joined once again by our old friend Dan McCarthy. You know, Dan, more and more, I'm getting people saying to me that you are one of the guests they look forward to most. You know,
well,
I have a whole variety of guests and people who are better known, lesser known, but people keep saying, you know, old trusty Dan McCarthy, I keep coming back to him for level-headed analysis. So welcome back. Dan, of course, is editor of Modern Age, which is a publication, I suppose, of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. And we're going to have a little bit to say about that a little bit later, because there's been a really great development in that arena. And I will say just very quickly about Modern Age that Dan edits, that over the years, Modern Age has featured almost anybody who's anybody in the conservative world, even the libertarian world. So Murray Rothbard published in there, but also really anybody you can think of who was significant. And one of the really great and interesting debates that occurred within the conservative movement over the idea of equality we see taking place between, Harry Jaffa and Emmy Bradford in the pages of Modern Age. So Modern Age has been the outlet for intellectual conservatism since 1957. So anyway, Dan, we will return to that in a minute. But I want to start off with a question that a lot of people are kind of wondering about, those of us who follow politics. Now that Donald Trump has officially has the Republican nomination wrapped up, even though de facto he more or less had it wrapped up some time ago, the question now is who's going to be the number two on the ticket? And there's a lot of speculation about who that might be. And there's a lot of, let's say there are maybe a handful of people that I could say have a big constituency behind them that would like to see them the number two on the ticket, but we may wind up being disappointed yet again. So what do you think's happening? Or walk us through some of the most commonly heard names that are being bandied about.
Yeah, before I do that, I want to really emphasize what the stakes here are. Now, obviously, the fact that Donald Trump has already served one term as president means that he'll have at most one more term if he wins in November, which means that his vice president is really set up to become the Republican Party's nominee in 2028 and quite possibly president thereafter. Now, historically, really going all the way back to the Reagan administration, neoconservatives have been extremely clever and have used the vice president's office as their power base within Republican administrations. And that's true of every single Republican administration from Reagan through to the first Donald Trump term. Think about it. With Ronald Reagan, you had as vice president George H.W. Bush. Now, Reagan was not a neocon. Reagan was someone who believed in trying to shrink government. He wanted to emphasize cutting taxes. He wanted to emphasize freedom. And in foreign policy, even though a lot of people thought of him as being this kind of apocalyptic showdown with the Soviet Union, uber hawk, in fact, he was seeking genuine peace through strength. And you saw that he didn't want to get us entangled into Middle East conflicts. He pulled us out of Lebanon, in fact, when American troops were murdered there by terrorists. He was very careful to negotiate with the Soviet Union. He always made it very clear that the Soviet Union was morally evil, but he didn't think that going to war with the Soviet Union was going to be either the answer or a necessary thing. He thought instead that reaching through to the humanity of the Russian people and even the humanity of Russian leaders was going to be sufficient to start to unwind the Cold War and bring us to a peaceful resolution of it. George H.W. Bush, on the other hand, Reagan's vice president, he was always, from his days back in the CIA, a very hawkish individual. And of course, once he becomes president after the Cold War, he embarks America on this new global mission, which has become a debacle over the last 30 years. It's George H.W. Bush who gets us into, first we have this little mini war in Panama, then we later have this first Gulf War, which in fact becomes an endless war. It becomes open-ended. The first Gulf War doesn't really end in 1991 with throwing Saddam Hussein's forces out of Kuwait. Instead, it becomes this protracted policing effort in the Middle East. We have troops in Saudi Arabia. We have a no-fly zone over Iraq. And basically, the scene is set for the Iraq War when George H.W. Bush's son, George W. Bush, becomes president. Now, people know that George H.W. Bush was a vice president who was not on board with Reagan's agenda. What they don't know, probably, and I think this has come to as a surprise to many of the young libertarians and young conservatives of my acquaintance, is that Dan Quayle, who was the vice president under George H.W. Bush from 1989 to 1993, Dan Quayle had as his chief of staff the little kingpin of neoconservatism, William Kristol. So Bill Kristol goes on to found Project for a New American Century, goes on to found the Weekly Standard. Today, he's running the Bulwark. Bill Kristol was chief of staff to the vice president when Dan Quayle was the VP. So that goes to show just, you know, how smart these people are to invest in an office that most people consider to be worthless. There's a famous historical description of the vice presidency as being, you know, worth about a bucket of warm spit. And you can imagine that if you're a staffer, a chief of staff, for example, to the vice president, well, that seems like less than nothing. You have almost no direct policy influence. But in fact, you're right there in the executive branch, having all kinds of indirect influence and really able to influence things powerfully. Well, of course, when the second George Bush, George W. Bush, becomes president after the 2000 election, who does he have as his vice president? He has, you know, a longtime American Enterprise Institute connected former Secretary of Defense and a so-called defense intellectual, Dick Cheney, who becomes a key player in the war on terror, as it was called at the time, and generally the expansive foreign policy, the really aggressive nation-building and world-transforming, revolutionary, basically, foreign policy that George W. Bush pursues. So once again, the vice president's office with Dick Cheney becomes the hive and the nexus of neoconservative power in even the George W. Bush administration, which was already quite neoconservative. So you can see, even if you have a bad president, you can have an even worse vice president. Well, then finally, we get Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is a complete repudiation of the Bush legacy. His repudiation of George H.W. Bush and also a repudiation of George W. And of course, he humiliates Jeb Bush in the 2016 primaries. Well, Donald Trump chooses as his vice president, Mike Pence. And Mike Pence, you know, seems like a pretty typical Republican, not really any more neoconservative than the ordinary Republicans of the 2000s or 2010s. But Mike Pence's office, among his staffers, there are people who actually play a very powerful role behind the scenes in sabotaging some of the better people, some of the better non-interventionists and foreign policy realists, for example, who had a shot at getting nominations within the Donald Trump administration. And of course, people within the vice president's office are also in on the conversations about national security staffing and other things. And therefore, they're able to keep neoconservative resumes in the pipeline with the endorsement of the vice president's office, which is one of the reasons why Trump winds up being so outflanked within his own administration by people who do not agree with him on fundamental policies, whether it's trade or immigration, or especially foreign policy and war. So all of that is a preamble to say the stakes could not possibly be higher, not only because Donald Trump's pick for vice president this time has a very good shot at becoming the Republican nominee in 2028 and becoming ultimately perhaps president, but also because that person and his or her office in the next Trump administration is going to be either a major source of neoconservative influence within the administration, or for once, we could have a dramatic change where you actually have a vice president and a vice presidential staff that are loyal to the president and loyal to a non-neoconservative agenda.
All right. Well, let me recall something you said on a previous episode. I feel fairly certain that I raised to you an objection to Trump along the lines that you've heard many times, no doubt, that he's not a good chooser of personnel, let's say, and that he surrounded himself with some bad people. Not all of them bad, but some of them bad. And some of them, you didn't exactly have to hire a private detective to figure out that they were bad and that they were at odds with him and his agenda. And you at least insinuated that he'll be better this time, that perhaps he's duly chastened or he's better informed or whatever. But if that were the case, then why is everybody worrying about his VP pick? You know, isn't he better now? Isn't he better at having good advisors telling him, you know, which person to choose? Or even better, I don't need any advisors to decide who would be a good VP pick. Why does he? So what's happening here in terms of Trump being a different, better, worse, or the same person that he was in 2016?
Well, it's not just about Trump. It's about the people around him. And Trump went into the White House in 2017 without having really the network of political contacts that you need in order to fill White House offices. It's not that there weren't people out there who could have done the job, but there are always these filters in politics. And you'll remember that the RNC by that point was actually quite close to Trump. You had Jared Kushner, Trump's own son-in-law. A number of people who were in very influential positions were able to tell Trump, okay, you know, bring this person in. Trump had no idea who most of these folks were. He simply trusted.
But I feel like, Dan, you're just pushing it back a level. How did those people get into his circle? The circle doesn't come out of the womb or out of the sky or something.
No, but I mean, you know, his son-in-law had been part of the family. So that's obviously a special vector of influence. No, when you're running for the Republican, you know, nomination, as Trump was in 2016, it was very important to him that the Republican National Committee not try to pull the rug out from under him, which I really thought they were going to do. Now, the head of the Republican National Committee at that time, to my surprise, actually gave Trump a fair shot. He didn't completely sabotage Trump, as I expected, in the primaries and then subsequently at the convention itself. That earned a certain amount of respect from Trump. It was rather short-lived because Trump realized very soon that the RNC was actually quite a problematic institution. But at that time, he thought, well, they've given me a shot. And remember, Trump is by nature very transactional. And he's actually he can be loyal to people who are part of a coalition that is invested in him. So if he gets the impression that these people are supporting him, he will actually be quite willing to give them a certain degree of support in return. The other thing is that Trump, one of his advantages, but also his disadvantages, is that he's not ideological at all. He has pretty sound personal instincts. He has a pretty common sense view of the world, but he doesn't, you know, really spend his days and nights thinking about, you know, who's a neoconservative and who's, you know, a paleoconservative or a fusionist. So he's quite naive, I think, about these facts of inner workings of politics. And, you know, he's used to being a CEO where you hire someone and, you know, you can fire them at will. And you expect them to be loyal, and their job and their whole career in the future depends on serving the business that they're working for and the person in charge of that business. Well, of course, in government, none of that applies. In government, you have people who will, you know, stab you in the back, even if they're drawing a paycheck from you. And you have people who are, you know, see their future career advancement as being lying in their ability to cash in on their betrayal of you or their previous connection with you. They don't feel any sense that, you know, their prosperity or doom depends on their loyalty. So they have terrible incentives. The existing network of the Republican Party in terms of who was credentialed to serve in various offices was, of course, defined by the fact that you had just had, before Trump, two previous Republican administrations, the George H.W. Bush administration and then the George W. Bush administration. So if you went and, as most presidential administrations do, tried to hire people who had served in the last administration of your party, that meant you had a ton of Bush resumes. And many of the neoconservatives and many people who are antithetical to Trump's agenda, they're very clever and they don't simply announce the fact that they hate him and they oppose him. They don't necessarily go as far as a David French or a Bill Kristol. Some of them will say, okay, well, we didn't like Trump, but now that he's the nominee, we're going to support him. And there's an unfortunate tendency, which you see even in Trump, and you certainly see it in others as well, which is kind of a perverse reading of the prodigal son parable, where the people who you bring onto your coalition last tend to be the people that you think, okay, they're doing me the biggest favor because they're giving me support at a time when I didn't have their support previously. And it can be very easy, and unfortunately, I think we did see this with Trump in 2016, to take for granted the people who had supported you in the first place. Now, Trump did make Jeff Sessions, you know, attorney general. But then because of the whole mess with the FBI, and he wound up being alienated with Sessions very quickly. And since then, Trump had a whole series of problems with appointments to, you know, the Justice Department, to the cabinet. And, you know, obviously in foreign policy, the neocons had far more credentials. Very few of our people had served in any kind of capacity. And so all of these lower level people, the other thing too is that running the executive branch, it's a massive bureaucracy. There is a limited amount of capacity for a president to actually go and make individual hiring decisions, especially below not just cabinet levels, but even under secretary levels. There's so many of these federal employees, so many of these federal jobs that have a tremendous influence in the aggregate in terms of shaping how presidential administrations behave. And below a certain level, the president is delegating and deferring the decision-making about this, not just to the people that he picks, but to the networks that are accustomed to filling these roles. So all of that was a disaster. Now, one reason I'm confident about, you know, and somewhat optimistic about what's going to happen in 2024, 2025 going forward, if Trump wins the White House again, is that you now actually have some countervailing networks. And I'm impressed by the work that the Heritage Foundation has done, but there are others that are actually much more even acutely aware of the danger of subversion within the administration, even than some of the things that are more widely known. There are now people who did get foreign policy experience, for example, in the first administration who are solid and who are prepared to come back into a second administration in a higher role. There are also a lot of young people who recognize the madness of neoconservatism and have now organized, you know, just the other night, I was at a gala for a group called American Moment. This is a new group that sprang up around 2020, and it is young conservatives who are strongly in favor of Trump's agenda, who are acutely aware of the dangers of neoconservative staffing and are therefore trying to staff not just administrations, but also Capitol Hill with people who are much more reliable and people who have the right knowledge. I've lectured for some of their Capitol Hill interns and fellows, for example. So there is some progress being made here, and this gives Trump a pool upon which to draw. But Trump is still going to be somewhat unaware of just how deep some of these divisions and some of these conflicts go. So it really depends a lot on the people, you know, quite several steps below Trump, not just on Trump himself.
Incidentally, before we say any specific names being considered potentially, we presume, for VP, there's one person I'm just curious to ask you about, and I don't know if you have any particular insight or even if he's interested in coming back, but do you think, despite his, I think he's in his late 70s now, there would be any prospect of a Colonel Douglas MacGregor coming back into the federal government?
I think certainly someone that is viewed favorably by Trump and many people around Donald Trump. Now, MacGregor has been made a controversial figure by a number of critics. You know, and he is a very outspoken individual, which is also one of the things that makes him a very important voice in our public conversation. All of which means that he would probably face a lot of opposition when it came to getting a confirmation, for example, from the U.S. Senate. Now, it's possible that he could be put in a national security role that doesn't require SAG confirmation or any number of other byways. So I would not rule out the idea that someone like him might return to government and might play a very important role. But at the same time, I can also see that there, with MacGregor in particular, there are a lot of forces arrayed against him, which will make it tough.
Okay. I'm just delighted to hear that Hillsdale College, where friend of the show Brad Berzer teaches, is offering more than 40 free online courses in the most important and enduring subjects. You can learn about the works of C.S. Lewis, the stories in the Book of Genesis, the meaning of the U.S. Constitution, the rise and fall of the Roman Republic, or the history of the ancient Christian church with Hillsdale College's online courses, all available for free. That's right, for free. I personally recommend you sign up for C.S. Lewis on Christianity. In this 7-lecture course, you'll examine some of Lewis's classic works, including Mere Christianity, The Screwtape Letters, and The Abolition of Man, to see what Lewis had to say about scripture, prayer, suffering, joy, heaven, and hell. The course is self-paced, so you can start whenever and wherever. Enroll now in C.S. Lewis on Christianity to discover Lewis's core lessons regarding the truth and goodness of the Christian faith and how to apply those lessons to your life. So, go right now to hillsdale.edu/woods to enroll. There's no cost and it's easy to get started. That's hillsdale.edu/woods to register. hillsdale.edu/woods.
All right, let's talk about the VP thing. I know that there are a lot of people who became very excited about the prospects of Vivek Ramaswamy because he was, in fact, I asked Paul Gottfried about him just a few days ago on this show. And Paul's not easily impressed. And Paul, you know, is inclined. Paul's been burned a number of times. And I think he's not super liberal with compliments. You have to really impress him. And he's very impressed with Vivek and how quick on his feet he is and how well-spoken he is and so on and on. And he had a lot of people saying that he could generate a lot of excitement. But the calculations that go into deciding who becomes the VP candidate don't really end with those considerations. So what exactly does Trump, in your opinion, should he be looking for? Not what we in our heart of hearts might want him to do, but what, from just a sheer political calculation standpoint, he needs to be looking for.
Even beyond political calculation, we have seen with the lawfare that progressives are waging against Donald Trump and their attempt to put him in prison, that he has to think very carefully about selecting a running mate who is not only going to have a very good possibility of succeeding him as president, but who will also, once, you know, this running mate, if he ever becomes president or she becomes president, will remain grateful to Donald Trump for having given this person a boost. So in other words, you could imagine a scenario where a future Republican president after Trump, who has been promoted by Trump, decides, well, you know, now that I'm in charge and now that I have all the political capital, I don't want to expend it on making sure that Donald Trump isn't sent to jail by his political enemies. You could see, any number of people who are enthusiastic about Trump while they think he can help them, but who would suddenly turn on him if they see him as a liability. There are a number of people like that who are out in the field. And Donald Trump, I think, has to be very careful not to select someone who is not going to continue to be loyal to him. And of course, progressives present this as, oh, personal loyalty, it's making a cult of the president. Well, no, you have people who on all kinds of spurious grounds, which are increasingly getting thrown out by the Supreme Court and thrown out by other judges and just exposed for all sorts of corruption in terms of prosecutors and judges and others. All of these, you know, campaigns that are political campaigns being waged using law as a weapon to try to destroy Donald Trump financially, to try to send him to jail. It is unlimited. They will not stop during a second Trump administration. They won't stop after a second Trump administration. They will not stop until Donald Trump is in the grave. So I think on a personal level, but also, you know, a level that is important for America's stability as a nation, he has to choose a vice president who's going to be faithful in a way that a lot of career politicians will not be. I mean, he's under tremendous pressure to do the identity politics thing. And nowadays it's assumed, well, you know, you have to have someone who is either a minority or a woman or maybe both on the ticket, that would be the obviously smart thing to do. And Joe Biden kind of thought that back in 2020 when he picked Kamala Harris. She's non-white, she's a woman, okay, that's great. That's what a diverse 21st century political ticket needs. Of course, Kamala Harris is a tremendous liability to Joe Biden. And one reason that the Democrats can't replace Joe Biden with someone else, because they know Joe Biden is, you know, a very likely loser in November, but Kamala Harris is next in line. So the Democrats have this dilemma. They've got to get rid of Joe Biden, but they also have to get rid of Kamala Harris if they want to have a winning ticket or a potentially winning ticket in November of 2024. So maybe I think Donald Trump should think twice about this pressure that he's under to choose a woman just for the sake of having a woman, or to choose Tim Scott just because Tim Scott is African-American. I don't know that that's going to really work. And the idea is, well, okay, there are a lot of suburban women who are uncomfortable with Trump, and maybe having a woman as his running mate would be reassuring to them and it would get some votes that Trump wouldn't otherwise get. That's kind of unlikely, though. Actually, very few people vote on the basis of a VP. Certainly, you know, on the basis of kind of national identity politics like that. I think there may be a little bit more truth in the idea that if more Black voters were already, you know, in many cases alienated with the Democrats and starting to look a little more kindly upon Donald Trump, if they see someone like Tim Scott as a running mate, they might say, oh, wait a minute. So maybe the dam is breaking. Maybe we're actually showing that that Black people do not have to vote for the Democratic Party. They can serve in the Republican Party and get promoted to a very high level. But then on the other hand, you know, in terms of policy, I think Tim Scott is not terribly advantageous for Donald Trump. And Tim Scott, if you were, you know, there's the famous office meme where you're shown two photos by corporate and you're supposed to say, oh, there's no difference between these photos. You showed a picture of Mike Pence and Tim Scott. If corporate showed you those photos, the correct response would be, oh, there's no difference between them, which is really true. Tim Scott is sort of the 2024 version of Mike Pence in 2016. I am very skeptical of the utility of identity politics. I'm very skeptical of the caliber of candidates who might be put on the ticket based on gender or on race. Some of the leading names that get thrown out, there's, you know, Kristi Noem, who's the governor of South Dakota, but social conservatives have felt burned by her because she has not been, you know, consistent on combating radical transgender medical activism. You know, and she has some other liabilities as well. And South Dakota doesn't really bring you much in terms of adding electoral votes that you don't already have in a general election. The other woman who's probably at the top of the list is Elise Stefanik, who is a representative, a congresswoman from the state of New York. Now, today, Stefanik, she's very smart. She is quite aggressive in defending Donald Trump, which is why he likes her. He sees her on television and he sees that she's an outspoken Trump defender. However, he needs to look at her background, because when she was first elected to Congress, she was hailed as the next wave of Republican moderates. She was seen as being a kind of idol for Republican feminists and for a sort of kinder, gentler face of the Republican Party. But, you know, even before that, one of her first jobs, in fact, it may even have been her very first job coming out of Harvard University, was working for the Foreign Policy Initiative, which was Bill Kristol's successor, the Project for a New American Century. So her background is actually with neoconservatism. And even though Bill Kristol now denounces her for supporting Trump, I don't know that the leopard has really changed its spots. And I would not at all trust Elise Stefanik to be a vice president who would be loyal to Trump, loyal to Trump's agenda and principles, and who, if she ever became president herself, would continue to follow an America First agenda rather than reverting to something more like a George W. Bush program. So I think both of those are quite worrying picks. Stefanik much more so than Kristi Noem. But I can tell you in a moment who my favorite pick is, but perhaps you have some other questions and other possibilities.
Well, it seems like if he picks one of these people who, if you took some time to look into their background, you would instantly see they're unsuited to this. I think we could agree that's a bad sign for the future. That's a bad sign because the number two spot for all the, as you say, the rhetorical disrespect shown to it can actually be more influential than people think. This is a critical thing. He's got to think this through. And if he comes up with one of these names, it's a very bad sign. Well, in terms of what you were saying about choosing somebody on the basis of their minority status, I just have this gut instinct that even though that doesn't work as well as the people who favor it think it does, I do think to the extent that it works, except in the case of an obviously incompetent candidate like Kamala Harris, I'll grant you that. But I think it works better for the left than it does for the right, because the right will never get any credit for it. The person will just be smeared as a token, whereas the left, it's a new breakthrough, it's a historic moment. So I think the right is playing a game that the rules are written so that it can't win.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You certainly didn't see Republicans get any credit for having Sarah Palin as a vice presidential running mate for John McCain.
Yeah, no. All right, so let's save the better people for the end. Maybe we could do them in order. They get successively better. I don't know if you can mentally arrange them, but tell me who else is out there.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of the most likely contenders.
Are the most likely ones.
They're certainly towards, at least as far as speculation goes, and it does seem like the speculation has some roots within circles that are close to Trump. Which is not to say that the decision has been made in favor of any of those. And I do get the impression sometimes that these are trial balloons that are being floated just to see how much enthusiasm they actually generate and how much pushback they generate.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think those are, you know, Trump really has been impressed by Stefanik speaking up for him. I think, you know, Trump also sees, you know, the idea of someone like Tim Scott as possibly a way to stick it in the Democrats' faces that they're losing a bit of the black male vote. The African-American man vote, that is, not black male in the other sense.
We know what you mean.
That's a factor in politics too, but not in the same way. I think there are very few conventional Republicans, old guard Republicans, or Mike Pence types who are seriously under consideration. Now, we talked about someone like Vivek, who would be more of a left field choice. And I think Donald Trump really does like Vivek. And I think he, you know, does think that he would be faithful and loyal. So I think Vivek, even though he's seen as a long shot in terms of what he would bring politically, I think he probably is being seriously considered. In fact, I'm pretty sure that he is, because we know The Secret Service has been looking out for Vivek's home and other things. So he is a contender. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of establishment pressure not to pick Vivek. People are going to say, well, look, Donald, you are polarizing yourself. Vivek is even more polarizing. You know, look at these polls that say he's unpopular. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to sideline Vivek. But Donald Trump will make the choice based on his own instincts as opposed to what he's advised to do. By the way, I think the reason he chose Pence, I mean, he realized, again, he's a very smart coalition builder. And he realized after the 2016 primaries, there were a significant number of Republicans, you know, at that point, who still had doubts about him. It's not that they were opposed to him. They weren't never Trumpers, but they weren't enthusiastic. They were worried about him. He wanted to make sure that they felt reassured so that they would come out in force to elect him as president in November of 2016. Mike Pence was a very good choice to provide that reassurance. He was an absolutely conventional Republican. He was popular with evangelicals and religious conservatives. He was a governor. He had governing experience, whereas Donald Trump had no political experience. So those were the calculations that I think were decisive in 2016. In 2024, of course, Trump is he is the overwhelming choice of the Republican Party. There really isn't a significant block of the party that's against him. Nikki Haley's support was mostly coming from Democrats and people who don't vote for Republicans. And of course, Donald Trump has experience as president, so he doesn't need a governor or anyone else with any level of experience to provide something that he's missing on the ticket. So that actually opens him up, I think, to choose someone inexperienced like Vivek if he wants to do so. Also, occasionally, on thread that I think would be more promising for us, just like Vivek, you also have Tulsi Gabbard's names occasionally thrown out in contention. But the odds of that, of course, are very low because Tulsi Gabbard was still a Democrat even 4 years ago. Some of her positions and views are not quite aligned with the Republican Party yet. I think they probably will come into alignment. And I think this is a genuine sort of change with Tulsi Gabbard. But it's probably premature for her to be, you know, having a national profile as a Republican leader.
All right. So is this the part of the episode where we get to J.D. Vance?
It is indeed. I think that the best choice for Donald Trump would be Senator Vance from Ohio. And one reason for this is certainly that Vance has become very loyal to Donald Trump and has stuck his neck out supporting Donald Trump at a time when a lot of people were rallying to Ron DeSantis and when it was really not entirely clear that Donald Trump would be able to be on the ballot. Vance has been dependable. So I think that counts for a lot. And Vance, you know, had been critical of Donald Trump in 2016 as Donald Trump had first emerged on the political scene. But of course, a lot of people who've gone on have a much stronger appreciation of Trump were dubious for a variety of reasons in 2016, just because Trump was so unexampled and so different from everything else we've seen. In terms of the traditional political wisdom of putting on your ticket someone who might help you get some electoral votes that you otherwise wouldn't get, Vance is actually very helpful there, despite the fact that he comes from a solidly red state in presidential elections. So Donald Trump doesn't need Vance in order to win Ohio, but he could use Vance in order to win a lot of the Rust Belt states that are nearby. So someone like J.D. Vance, for example, clearly would have won the Senate election in Pennsylvania in 2022, which Mehmet Oz lost to Fetterman. So J.D. Vance, I think, would help the Republican ticket in Pennsylvania. I think he would also help in other Rust Belt states like Michigan and Wisconsin. So geographically, I think there are a lot of electoral votes that Donald Trump absolutely needs to win if he wants to become president, which he has a slightly improved chance of winning if he has someone like J.D. Vance, who has a very good way of talking to working class voters, on the ticket.
I had J.D. Vance on the show some time ago because he had that book, Hillbilly Elegy. They eventually made that into a movie, maybe before they knew much about him. I don't know, because there were some big names in that movie. But I don't know what his voting record is like. I'm just saying I haven't really followed him. I've heard some speeches he's given that sounded pretty good to me, but I don't know him in much depth. But that conversation I had with him was very impressive. And that book that he wrote about his background and his experience growing up in a, I hate to use this word, dysfunctional, but I don't know what other word you could use to describe his upbringing, the family, the local culture, and everything, and that these are largely forgotten people, was very, very impressive and left an impression on me for quite some time. And I would certainly prefer him over any of those names you mentioned before. And I think you'd be crazy not to.
Yeah, I think Vance is the real thing, both in his head and in his heart. And that's not to say that he's perfect. It's not to say that I agree with him on everything. But I think he is extremely promising. He's very young. He's younger than you and I are. And he could be a very important successor to Donald Trump in the White House. And there's a very strong logic in favor of picking him. Now, all the conventional political analysts and conventional wisdom would say that, well, J.D. Vance is a white male and he's coming from a red state. Why would you possibly pick him? What could he possibly add? You really need diversity. You really need to have a woman on the ticket. But no, the traditional view that, you know, you should at least try to get some electoral votes you can't otherwise get, which, you know, maybe having a woman would help with that. Maybe that would bring the suburbs in. But I think that's more of a gamble than saying, actually, J.D. Vance helps to reassure the sort of blue-collar workers who made Donald Trump president in 2016, but who in many cases either didn't vote for Donald Trump in 2020 or simply didn't turn out in the numbers necessary in order to keep states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania in the Trump column. So he is someone who can actually make a material difference in the states that we know are battlegrounds.
Also, I feel like if somebody were to write a full-blown report on it, it would not turn out that the Republican Party had had tremendous success attempting in this kind of sledgehammer way to appeal to minority groups, even though we are assured every time they try it that this will be just the thing that will bring these demographics over to the Republican Party. It just winds up alienating the base, which thinks, so you're going to engage in these gimmicks too, just the way these other people are. And so even though you could perhaps understand why people might think it would work, I just don't think it has a really big track record of success behind it.
It's true. And Donald Trump, of course, did basically the opposite of everything that the, you know, sensitivity consultants would tell someone like Trump to do. And he was still winning, you know, a larger share of Hispanics and African Americans. So I think they, you know, Black voters and Latino voters, they respect someone who is authentically populist and authentically on the right. And they like someone who is as outspoken and frank as Donald Trump. And they know when they're being sold something that's kind of mushy and calculated to just tell them what they want to hear. They never buy that, which is why all these Republican efforts to deliberately prioritize diversity and court non-white voters, they fail because they're patronizing, and they fail because they're obviously, it's not that they're insincere, it's that they're totally artificial and they're totally aimed at a white liberal's or even a sort of white center-right person's idea of what minorities care about. Whereas right. The truth is, a lot of minorities care about exactly the same things that blue-collar conservative whites care about. They care about the border. They care about, you know, national pride. They care about jobs for certain. And they care, you know, oftentimes about some of these social issues as well. You won't necessarily win over a massive block of voters who are not traditionally aligned with the Republican Party all at once. But I think you do see progress incrementally. And my guess is that someone like Tim Scott, there probably would slightly be a greater increment with someone like him on the ticket, maybe with some of the women candidates as well. But it would not be dramatic. It would not be game-changing. Whereas we know that the key to Donald Trump winning again in 2024 comes down to only like four or five battleground states. And a lot of those are the kind of states that J.D. Vance appeals to.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Persist SEO. If you are getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO. If you are a small local business trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, then increase your visibility with Persist SEO. What if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis? Well, then website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. Are you tired of cold calling and networking, meeting places getting shut down? Use your website as a lead generation engine. Or what if you're not showing up for your services in the search engines? Well, get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. All right, I think I'd like to transition now into something completely different, and that involves the publication Modern Age, which, as I say, has so many important issues have been hashed out in those pages over the years. Even Ol Woods has written for Modern Age. And you guys just, now, when you come on this show, I always say to people, the website is modernagejournal.com. But the little secret of that was that actually that was just a redirect to a page on the Intercollegiate Studies Institute website. Now you have your own thing. Modernagejournal.com takes you to a full-blown website, which, by the way, is beautiful and is organized into various sections that I think people will find helpful. And there's a lot of stuff there from our past. And I think there's a lot of value in going over some of the issues that have been debated before, because a lot of things that go on today, people are, in one way or another, rehashing issues that we have talked about as if they've never been brought up before. And it's useful to know what, frankly, much smarter people said about them in the past. So tell me about this new site.
Yeah, so it's not just the URL is now pointing to a site that is a force unto itself, but this is a site that now has daily content. And it's a mixture of newly commissioned web articles, plus material from the latest print issues, and some of these classic archival pieces from decades past. And it's bringing them all together, which I think is the real art of the modern age website, is making us all participate in this conversation across generations and putting the greatest minds of the last 6 or 7 decades of the American right, conservative, libertarian, West Coast Straussian, everything, into conversation with the greatest minds of today. And we've got some great material coming from new people in the weeks to come. We have Chris Rufo will have a piece on the site. Our editorial assistant, Jillian Parks, has done a fascinating interview with Naomi Wolf, which I think conservatives will find very eye-opening and intriguing. We have material from some of our recent print issues, including a great interview between Jean Callahan and the British philosopher John Gray, who is well known to libertarians for his work on Hayek, but then later Gray becomes quite critical of libertarianism and almost every other ideology too. So I think you'll find that the Modern Age website is a place for kind of deep philosophical reflection on events and on controversies that are quite current, even if those controversies and events in some cases happened decades ago. But certainly the ones that are happening today, they have a ancestry, a genealogy, and it's important to know that in order to understand the way things are working. Just as we said earlier in our conversation, it would really have been good if Donald Trump understood what a neoconservative or a paleoconservative or a libertarian or Rothbardian, if he knew what those categories were going into government, that would have allowed him to make a much stronger administration in 2016 and forward. Similarly, I think intellectuals out there, scholars, students, business people, and political leaders as well, by going to Modern Age and discovering these sort of bigger pictures of conservative thought, and, you know, not just conservative thought, but really thought that crosses the boundaries, conservatism and libertarianism and other adjacent philosophies, I think they will be much better informed as citizens, much better informed as business people, as people involved in politics. And they'll also find it tremendously enjoyable that we live in a time of urgency and an overwhelming flow of information in the news cycle. And there's relatively little opportunity for people to step back and read something that is reflective rather than focused on something that has happened, you know, in the last half hour. Well, the Modern Age website, modernagejournal.com, presents reflective material. Even if it's about recent events, it's going to have a long view of those events. And it's going to talk about philosophy, culture, the arts. We have a film and stage critic, Noah Millman, who just does brilliant work, you know, in the print magazine and now also on the website. So you'll find, you know, great coverage of popular culture as well as some philosophy that's going to be, I think, very edifying to listeners and watchers of The Tom Woods Show.
Do you want to give at least one specific example of things you'll find there? Because we were talking before we recorded about Frank Meyer, which is a name that may not be familiar to every listener, but he's somebody, now he was before my time, even when I was in college, but he was somebody I read when I was trying to situate myself in the history of the ideas that I was coming to adopt. You know, Murray Rothbard was very interested in the work of Frank Meyer, didn't always agree with him. Meyer was trying to bring traditional conservatives and libertarians together by showing what they had in common. That was part of what he was up to. But I thought he was a very interesting person. I always found his work to be worthwhile. But maybe you can give us a specific example like that.
Yeah, Frank Meyer was known for this philosophy that gets branded as fusionism, which sounds like an artificial attempt to bring together libertarians and traditionalists. But Meyer really, in his deepest heart, wanted to show that this was not a fusion. This was rather a shared heritage and a shared tradition going back even to the incarnation, even back to Jesus Christ. And this is fascinating because Meyer was, you know, Jewish. He then became a communist and an atheist. And only towards the very end of his life did he embrace Catholicism, or did he become formally a Roman Catholic. So there's this tremendous religious and personal journey, which is embodied by the tension that you find in his work between liberty and freedom, order, religion, politics. All of these things come together in a fascinating way. The most important essay that Frank Meyer ever wrote was one called Western Civilization, the Problem of Political Freedom. And right now at modernagejournal.com, we have that essay presented. Just scroll down a little bit on our homepage and you'll find a section called From the Archives. And Frank Meyer's essay is the lead piece there. And you'll also find in that From the Archives section some classics by a number of other thinkers, some of whom famously have had sharp elbows and have had major disagreements with other conservative figures. So we have an essay by Harry Jaffa, the dean of West Coast Straussianism, on his mentor Leo Strauss. We also have an essay which I really think Tom Wood's show viewers and listeners will find very valuable, an essay by Felix Morley, who is a forgotten conservative libertarian from the early part of the 20th century. Morley was part of the old right in the sense of people like Albert J. Nock and H.L. Mencken, the opponents of the New Deal and the opponents also of America becoming an empire. This essay by Felix Morley, which originally appeared in the first issue of Modern Age in 1957, is called American Republic or American Empire. And it's all about the military-industrial complex. It's written at the early days of the Cold War, and it's basically warning, you know, our citizens about the kinds of corruptions that are going to come to our republic as a result of embracing a kind of open-ended world mission. So all of these essays, I think, are things that will provide a foundation. You know, sometimes conservatism might not look like a serious school of thought because, you know, you look at the politicians and you even look at Donald Trump. You know, I'm voting for Donald Trump. I like him in so many ways. But obviously, you know, you don't necessarily look to Donald Trump as someone who's going to recommend a reading list to you. You don't look to Donald Trump to recommend, you know, kind of the roots of conservative philosophy and the branches that conservatism has today. Modern Age is there to fulfill that kind of mission. It's a place to say, okay, I want to see the best conservative argument about issue X, Y, or Z, both in the 21st century, but also in a timeless sense. ModernAgeJournal.com is the place where we have both the best arguments for today, but also the arguments that are for all eternity.
Well, I'm really happy for you, Dan. It's a great step forward. It's full of great resources. I'm already clicking on links there and reading what's available. So the tricky thing is that there's some study out there that says that people have some number of websites that they're prepared to visit on a regular basis. I don't know, it's like 13 or 14 or something like that. And then if you have a new one, they basically have to knock one out in order to integrate it in there. So what I would say to people is knock one out, okay? Mentally, in some way, think about what you could do without, because you can't do without what Dan McCarthy is doing over at modernagejournal.com. So check that out. And, you know, there are people writing pieces there I'd like to invite on the show and talk to them about it. Because, look, I get a lot of ideas from my email newsletter from Twitter. And Twitter really can be a really well, if you curate your follower list well enough, or you create lists on it, it can be a really good source of news items and opinion pieces. And that's been really helpful to me. But sometimes Twitter is not that. Sometimes it's a horror show of people, half of whom are just not entitled to an opinion on anything, arguing with other such people. And to have a respite from that, to have a really serious site with serious people grappling with serious things, I have to feel like surely there is a market for this out there. So I hope folks will indeed check it out, modernagejournal.com. Thanks so much again, Dan.
Thanks, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Wood Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.